we were covering judgments last week. So I am going to take care of that little squeal there real quick. Okay. Last week we were covering judgments, voiding judgments. And there's some interesting things in here that, you know, a lot of people don't even think about, especially the new people. And I know we've got new people on here. We're getting new people every week. And that is fantastic. And this is beneficial, especially to those of you that are new. But one of the big things about this is we have the legal citations to go along with some of these arguments. And for most people, that's been one of the biggest issues. I know that was something that was a huge issue for me for a period of time. When I was trying to do things, it's like, oh, geez, where do you find these case citations? You know, I don't have a subscription to Westlaw. I have a friend that does, but I can't keep asking her for things all the time. So when I bought these NCLC books and saw what was here, it was a virtual motherload of information, because it gives you the backup to make an argument and put a case citation behind it, which is what you have to do. Because if you look at the lawsuits that you're served with or the arguments that they make when you serve a lawsuit, they are going to put case citations in. That's what helps the judges make their decisions on what's going to happen. So bottom line is, there's a lot of information here. We're going to keep covering this. We're going to finish up the judgments, and then I've got a couple other things that I want to touch on a little bit tonight, and I'm not going to go real long on things tonight, and then we can get into the discussion, the general discussion with questions. So picking up the last thing we covered last week was fraud, misrepresentation, or misconduct by an opposing party. And, things like the collectors filing false affidavits with a court should not be just misconduct affecting a consumer, but also fraud upon the court. These are the types of things that we were talking about. So I'm going to pick up right where we left off last week. And we're going to cover, this is section 11.3.9.2. That's how detailed these books are with this information that they've got for us. A special case, mailing stipulations with the complaint. Now, this particular one here, I don't believe is something a lot of people are going to run into, but I want to get it out here. It is something that it can make a difference. A number of cases in Florida in 2007 and 2008 dealt with a collector's practice of including a stipulated judgment with the initial service of process of the summons and complaint. Oh boy, that's something. They just put a stipulated judgment right in with it. I'll make it easy for you to just stick it to yourself. The process server would deliver the summons and complaint and a cover letter from the collector's attorney, and a stipulation for entry of final judgment, execution withheld. The cover letter asked the consumer to contact the law firm to negotiate a payment amount that would be included in this stipulated judgment, which had the judgment amount pre-printed. You're supposed to negotiate an amount, but then the judgment that they send you had the amount pre-printed. You see a bit of a disconnect there? The letter stated that if an agreed amount is reached, the consumer would not have to go to court. The stipulation called for post-judgment interest of only 20.4%, almost double the statutory rate, and for the consumer to waive garnishment defenses. In other words, open the door so they can come and pick your pocket. A number of consumers contacted the law firm, were told what amount to include in the stipulation, and signed the stipulation. Florida courts have had little trouble setting aside such stipulated judgments. The courts point to the fact that the stipulations were illegally included with the court summons and that this misled the consumer as to the consequences of signing the stipulation, providing grounds to set aside the stipulated judgment. All right, and I've got some case citations here. If you have a situation like this, if you're in Florida and you were somebody that got into this, here's something to get you back out of it. Case citations are Capital One Bank v. Mullis, M-U-L-L-I-S. This Florida Duval County Court. It's November 28th of 2007. And it is available at www.consumerlaw.org/unreported. Second citation is Capital One Bank versus Brannon, spelled B-R-A-N-N-O-N. And that is a Duval County Court, August 17th from 2007, which is also available at consumerlaw.org/unreported. So boy, if you're in Florida, this is something that can really, really help you. If maybe you got stung with a judgment on one of these things in the past, you can get out of this because it was absolute fraud. It may have happened to you because you didn't know anything about it. Okay, the consumer was misled as to the stipulation's nature, her options, and was not informed of important legal rights she was forfeiting by signing same. Okay. You want to go ahead and reference the same cases. All right. Serving the stipulation and cover letter with the initial process simulates legal process and gives the document an air of authority and importance, even though it is not a true legal pleading. Okay, we're going to have the two citations that I just gave you will apply here also, and then I will give you one or two more here. Star Capital Acquisitions, LLC, versus Craig, spelled K-R-I-G. That is also out of Duval County. That is September 13th, 2006. Then there is also Capital One Bank. And it's really great that Capital One was involved in the shady stuff, huh? Capital One Bank versus Livingston, L-I-V-I-N-G-S-T-O-N. That is also Duval County, August 10th. of 2006. All right. Another ground for setting aside the stipulated judgment was that the stipulation is unconscionable and thus unenforceable. Okay, we're going to have the same citation with Capital One v. Mullis, and that is available at consumerlaw.org. And the one with Brannon as well. So they evidently covered that real well. And that is specific to Florida. That's where they had a problem with that. So if you happen to be one of the victims of that, there's your opportunity for your relief. Okay, let's go to section 11.3.10. The judgment is void. Improper service of the complaint or notice of the default hearing. In general, the most common example of a void judgment is where the defendant has never been properly served with the complaint and thus has had no notice that a legal proceeding is taking place. Another example is when the collector fails to provide the required notice to the consumer that a hearing for a default judgment is to take place. Funny thing, they have to tell you there's going to be a hearing for a default judgment. If service or notice is defective, then the court issuing the judgment does not have personal jurisdiction over the consumer, and the judgment is void. I'm going to read that again. It's very important. It doesn't mince any words. If service or notice is defective, then the court issuing the judgment does not have personal jurisdiction over the consumer, and the judgment is void. Some state rules explicitly provide that lack of jurisdiction is grounds to set aside a judgment. Okay. Case on that is Unifund, UNI, FUND, CCR Partners versus Dale, DALE. It's a New York City court. In fact, I'll give you the citation here. NYS, capital letters, N period, Y period, S period, 2D, small d, 782. That is a New York City court from 2005. Federal Rule 60B and other state rules provide for setting the judgment aside if the judgment is void. Lack of personal jurisdiction makes the judgment void. Oh boy, when we have case citations here, get ready. Wolf, W-O-L-F-E, versus Stevens. That is a Florida District Court appellate decision from 2007. Then there is First Select Company versus Mastromatty. That's the name. I'll spell that. M-A-S-T-R-O-M-A-T-T-E-I. It's a 2007 Massachusetts Appeals Division. Massachusetts District Court. Another one, Dombrowski, spelled D-O-M-B-R-O-W-S-K-I, V. Schute, C-H-U-T-E. It's a 2000 Massachusetts Appeals Court decision. Another one is Gassett, spelled G-A-S-S-E-T-T, versus Snappy Car Rental. And that is a 1995 Nevada decision. And I'll give you one more here. There's more than that, but I'm not going to belabor this. Unifund, CCR Partners. That's a familiar name to many of you. I'm sure you've heard it enough times. Unifund, CCR Partners versus Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y. That's an Oregon Court of Appeals case from 2010. All right. Inadequate service should suffice to set aside a judgment, even if a state's rules do not list lack of jurisdiction or a judgment being void as grounds to set aside a judgment. Okay, got case citations. Peralta, spelled P-E-R-A-L-T-A. Heights. Versus Heights, H-E-I-G-H-T-S, Medical Center. And this is a U.S. case, let's see, from 1988. I'm going to give you the information straight out of the book. It's 485, capital U, period, capital S, period, 80, comma, 108, south, or I should say S, period, CT, capital C, small t, period, 896, comma, 99 L, period, capital L, period, ED, capital E, small d, period, 2D, 75. And that's from 1988. And I see we have somebody here that needs to be muted in the chat, so we'll take care of that. We just did. All right. If the judgment is void, it is void. I mean, that's it. If it's void, it's void. I mean, there isn't any, well, you know, it might be partly void. It either is void or it is not void. Okay, lack of jurisdiction can be raised at any time to attack a judgment. And there's lots of case citations here. I'm going to read you several. Fort Trumbull, spelled T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L. Conservancy, C-O-N-S-E-R-V-A-N-C-Y, L-L-C. Versus Alves, spelled A-L. V-E-S. That is a Connecticut case from 2003. We also have Capital One Bank versus Zekala, spelled C-Z-E-K-A-L-A. And that is an Illinois appeals case from 2008. Next one is Young versus Progressive Casualty Insurance Company. And that is a Maryland Court of Special Appeals, 1996. And I'll give you one more, and there's a bunch of them in here. First Select Company versus Mastromatti, spelled M-A-S-T-R-O-M-A-T-T-E-I. It's a 2007 Massachusetts Appeals Division 77. All right. I'm going to go back and read this previous sentence, and then we'll go on. Lack of jurisdiction can be raised at any time to attack a judgment. As a result, there is no time limit to challenge a void judgment. Now, that's important. There's no time limit to challenge a void judgment. All right, I'm going to give you several citations. There's a bunch of them here. Master Finance, just F-I-N, period, Inc. versus Woodburn, W-O-O-D-B-U-R-N. That is a Arizona Court of Appeals from 2004. Then you have United Bank of Boulder. Versus Buchanan, spelled B-U-C-H-A-N-A-N. That is a 92 Colorado Appeals Court case. Another one is Faulkner, F-A-L-K-N-E-R, versus Ameritrust, A-M-E-R-I-T-R-U-S-T, Federal Savings and Loan Association. And that is a Florida District Court of Appeals case from 1986. Now, there's a whole bunch more in here, but I'm not going to read all of these. I'll give you several on each of these so you've got some ammunition when you're dealing with this. Okay, go back and read the previous sentence. Again, as a result, there is no time limit to challenge a void judgment. For example, in one case, the default judgment was set aside 6 years after it was issued because of defective service. Okay, there's a case citation here, which is First Select Company versus Master Matty. This is one we've obviously mentioned before. M-A-S-T-R-O. M-A-T-T-E-I. It is a 2007 Massachusetts Appeals Division 77 case. The consumer did not have to show that the delay was unreasonable, which I find very interesting, very powerful, and there is a case citation for that. Capital One Bank versus Zekala, spelled C-Z-E-K-A-L-A. It's an Illinois Appeals Court case from 2008. While it is prudent to do so, the consumer need not even show a meritorious defense. You know, it's a good idea to show some kind of a defense, but you don't have to. And the case citations on that are Peralta, P-E-R-A-L-T-A, versus Heights Medical Center, Inc., spelled H-E-I-G-H-T-S, Medical Center, Inc. And this is a long citation. I'm going to read this to you. 485, and then capital U, period, capital S, period, 80, comma, 108, capital S, period, capital C, small t, period, 896, comma, 99, capital L, period, capital E, small d, period, 2D, 75, and then 1988 in parentheses. Okay, we're also going to have Master Financial Incorporated versus Woodburn, W-O-O-D-B-U-R-N. And this is an Arizona Court of Appeals from 2004. Now, I'm sure you noticed that there's a lot of these that are cited for various things, which means that when you get one of these court cases that is cited for this and this and this and this, it's a really good case to go and make sure that you read and get the information out of it so that you can see the benefit out of it and you know how to be able to use it in the litigation that you're dealing with. Okay, once the lack of personal jurisdiction is established, the court has no discretion but to set aside the judgment. Okay, there is a couple of ones there. One of them is the First Select Company versus Master Matty. I'm not going to read that again. That's a Massachusetts case from 2007. Then we have Enterprise Rent-A-Car, Inc. versus Bigelow, B-I-G-E-L-O-W, which is a 2004 Massachusetts Appeals Division 165. And that is, again, out of 2004. I'll give you one more. Dombrowski, spelled D-O-M-B-R-O-W-S-K-I, versus Schute, C-H-U-T-E, 2000 Massachusetts Appeals, Division 127. And again, that's from 2000. All right. Now let's talk about sewer service. I'm sure some of you have heard about sewer service. I'm not talking about the pipe that runs from your house out to the street. Where state rules require that a summons be delivered by hand to the consumer's residence, a common cause of defective service is sewer service, where the individual tasked with visiting the consumer's residence and serving the summons fails to do so, but claims to have done so. For example, the New York Attorney General's office recently alleged that American Legal Process failed to properly serve consumers across New York State with legal papers and sought to throw out an estimated 100,000 default judgments. 100,000 default judgments because they don't serve the papers. What a racket are we running here, huh? In addition, Anne Fowl, as administrative judge of the New York Unified Court System, commenced a special proceeding against several law firms using American Legal Process, seeking to vacate all default judgments entered in cases where the service was made by American Legal Process servers. The action was settled by consent order. And if you want, I'll give you that information. See, matter of FAU, P-F, capital P-F-A-U, V, Forster, F-O-R-S-T-E-R, and Garbus, G Garbus. And that's a familiar name to me. And that is the New York Supreme Court from 2009, by the way. I helped somebody with a Forrester and Garbus case in New York, and they got their case dismissed. Another one is Palisades Collection, LLC, versus Cerrito, C-E-R-R-I-T-O, 906 North, or correction, capital N period, capital Y period, capital S period, 2 small d, 774, and that's New York, Poughkeepsie, and I'll spell that because most of you probably wouldn't get it right unless you live there, P-O-U-G-H-K-E-E-P-S-I-E, City Court, 2009. All right, the consumer will have to present evidence that service was not made, even though the processor claims to have made service. Seek through discovery or subpoena information to determine the actual route the process server used the day, or even just a portion of the day during which the consumer was allegedly served. It may be possible to show that the process server could not physically travel to all of the locations claimed in the time period specified. Even the sheer number of locations served in a day may create doubt in the court's mind and lead the court to place more credibility on the consumer's testimony. And by the way, I'm going to mention it here, and I don't know whether it'll be mentioned in what I'm reading here. You always deal with things with an affidavit. You always deal with it with an affidavit. You have to state your facts in an affidavit so that your facts are sworn testimony. And that affidavit needs to go with your motion to vacate a void judgment. Similarly, the minimal amount the server is paid per summons might indicate pressure on the server to engage in sewer service just to earn a living wage. Also persuasive would be testimony from other consumers denying receipt of process who were allegedly served by the same process server. Sometimes defects as to proper service of process are apparent on the face of the documents. In New York, if the summons is affixed to a door, a copy must also be mailed within 20 days. Where the collector's own documents indicate that the summons was mailed 28 days later, service is defective. Citation on that, and this could be very important to you. Velocity Investments, LLC. Versus McCaffrey, spelled M-C, capital C-A-F-F-R-E-Y. It's a New York District Court case, February 2nd of 2001. In California, both the process server and the process serving company must be listed on the proof of service, and this must include both of their names, addresses, phone numbers, and process serving license numbers. Again, I'm going to read that for all the people in California. All you Californians, here it is. In California, both the process server and the process serving company must be listed on the proof of service. And this must include both of their names, addresses, phone numbers, and process serving license numbers. If you don't have those things on something you've been served with, defective service, if you got a judgment out of it, you can get it voided. Check to see if the phone numbers and addresses are legitimate or purely fictitious. All right, let's talk about mail service to the wrong address, because this happens to people, and it's something you got to deal with. And when it happens, obviously, if they don't send it to the right place, there's a problem, and you should be able to deal with it and deal with a judgment as a result of it. More common than personal service are state rules that allow service by some combination of certified and first-class mail. A common failing with such service is that it will be sent to the wrong address. The frequency of this problem is magnified when debt buyers send service years after the consumer last had contact with the original creditor, and the debt buyer relies solely on address information the original creditor provided. Well, common sense. The general rule is that where first-class mail is not returned, service is presumed received if sent to the consumer's last and usual place of residence, even if the consumer is not at that location at the time. All right, I'm going to give you several case citations on this. Sears, Roebuck and Company versus Ford, F-O-R-D. And that is a 2006 Massachusetts Appeals Court, Division 172. Okay, we have Asset Acceptance, LLC, one of my favorite outfits. I'm going to be getting ready to sue them, versus Allen, A-L-L-E-N. It is Ohio Court of Appeals, September 30 of 09. And we'll do one more, Portfolio Recovery Associates, LLC, versus Rohan, R-O-H-A-N, and that is a New York Superior Court decision from 2009. All right, if certified mail is returned unclaimed, regular mail still constitutes adequate service, unless it too is returned. Okay, now that's, you want to pay attention to that. Sometimes if people are thinking about, well, how can I avoid service? If certified mail is returned unclaimed, regular mail still constitutes adequate service unless it too is returned. And this one case citation here is Asset Acceptance, LLC versus Allen, A-L-L-E-N, and that's an Ohio Court of Appeals case from September 30 of 09. All right. Of course, the rule is different if mail service is returned with an indication that the consumer is not at the address. For example, where a certified mailing was returned with the notation "in jail," this was sufficient to show that mail service was inadequate. Yeah, they'd have a bit of a problem picking up their mail there. Case citation on that, Palisades Collection, LLC, versus Brown. It's a New Jersey Superior Court of Appeals, December 15th of 2010, where Where first-class mail is sent and not returned, the consumer's mere denial of receipt without any evidence is usually considered inadequate to defeat service. That bears reading again. Where first-class mail is sent and not returned, the consumer's mere denial of receipt without any evidence is usually considered inadequate to defeat service. There's a case for that. ATL, I think it's Atlantic, but it's ATL period, credit and finance versus Dustrud, spelled D-U-S-T-R-U-D-E. And that's a Minnesota Court of Appeals, March 4 of 2008. However, mailing the summons is no more than a rebuttable presumption that service has been made. It's a rebuttable presumption. Case citation on that is Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Scott, S-C-O-T-T. New Jersey Superior Court of Appeals, October 30 of 07. And there, in parentheses behind that, it says, due process requires the judgment to be set aside. Imagine that. Another citation, TCC, Management, Inc. versus CLAPP, C-L-A-P-P. I need to do something here real quick. And that is an Ohio Appeals Court decision from August 23rd of 05. Okay, the mere fact that a collector sent a number of letters to the address that were not returned does not prove that service was proper. Okay, yeah, you send a lot of them, and they, you know, somebody there can go, ah, this is for somebody else, and they throw it in the trash. How many of you have ever done that? Case citation is one that we've already mentioned, which is the First Select Company versus Mastromatti, M-A-S-T-R-O-M-A-T-T-E-I, Massachusetts District Court from 2007, Division 77. Okay, this presumption, now here again I'll read the previous sentence, the mere fact that the collector sent a number of letters to the address that were not returned does not prove that service was proper. This presumption disappears when there is conflicting evidence. This is the case even where someone signs for a certified letter. The consumer can still provide evidence that the consumer did not reside at that address at the time. Case citation there is Liberty Credit Services, Inc. And versus Walsh, W-A-L-S-H. That is Ohio Court of Appeals, March 3rd of 2005. All right, when the consumer advances proof that rebuts the presumption of effective service, the burden may shift to the collector to establish that service was made. You know, that's pretty logical. Case citation on that is Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Scott. That's one we've mentioned before. which is New Jersey Superior Court of Appeals, October 30 of 07. The consumer is entitled to a hearing on the factual issue. Now, that's something in itself right there. You're entitled to a hearing on the factual issue. Case citations on that: Portfolio Recovery Associates, LLC, versus Thacker, T-H-A-C-K-E-R. That's Ohio Court of Appeals, August of 2009. And we have another one, TCC Management, Inc., versus CLAP. This is another one we've used before, CLAPP. This is Ohio Court of Appeals, August of 2005. And I'm going to give you one more. Ameritrust Company v. Spigutz, spelled S-P-I-G-U-T-Z. That's an Ohio Court of Appeals, November of 04. Again, the consumer is entitled to a hearing on the factual issue. This is particularly the case where the consumer offers an affidavit to prove that the consumer did not reside at the location served at the time of service. Okay, a couple citations there. Unifund CCR Partners versus Dale. And it's New York, Mount Vernon City Court. And 2005. And the other one is Liberty Credit Services, Inc. versus Walsh. It's a 2005 Ohio Court of Appeals, March of 05. Okay. Said they did not reside at the location served at the time of service or did not see the service. Okay. There's a citation for that, and it's one we've already seen before. TCC Management, Inc., versus CLAP, C-L-A-P-P. And that's an Ohio Court of Appeals, August of 05. An affidavit from the present occupant of the address denying the consumer resided there should also be sufficient to provide a hearing on the issue. There's no such thing as too much evidence, remember. You know, get affidavits from the people that were there. So, hey, they didn't live here. Everything you can do to buttress your case and get yourself a hearing. Okay, and there is a case citation for that, which is one that we've heard many times. First Select Company versus Master Matty. M-A-S-T-R-O-M-A-T-T-E-I. And that is a Massachusetts District Court, 2007. The consumer can also overcome the presumption as to proper service by showing that the consumer was incarcerated at the time of the service. Well, it's a little hard to serve you if you're not there. And the citation on that is NCO Portfolio Management versus Lorenzo, L-O-R-E-N-Z-O. And that is a New Jersey Superior Court Appellate Division, September of 2010. Particularly powerful is the consumer's affidavit that the consumer has never lived at the address listed in the summons. You know, common sense. I never lived there, but you have to do this in affidavit form. It's very important that you do that. A couple citations here, which we already have. First Select Company versus Master Matty. Again, you have that. That's a Massachusetts appeals, Division 77 from 2007. Then there's also Dombrowski versus Chute, C-H-U-T-E. We've already covered that one. That's also Massachusetts District Court from 2000. And also there is NCO Portfolio Management versus Lorenzo, one that we just mentioned a little bit ago. And that is New Jersey from September of 10. This can happen in any, let me go back and read the previous sentence. Particularly powerful is a consumer's affidavit that the consumer has never lived at the address listed in the summons. This can happen in any number of ways. Sloppy record keeping can result in small errors that send the service to the wrong address. For example, a presumption was rebutted when the consumer lived on 211 Keats Drive and the summons and complaint were mailed to 211 Keats Court. Okay, there is actually a case citation for that, one that we've had before. Asset Acceptance LLC versus Scott. New Jersey Superior Court, October of 07. Okay, I was just looking at what's on the board here. Guest 18, I'm going to address your comments. That comes in due time. This is a specific educational segment of the call, and it will continue. Other times, the collector will rely on credit reports or skip tracing to locate the consumer's new address, and errors will occur in that process. Thus, in one case, a skip tracing services information that someone with a consumer's name lived at the address at the time of the summons was not determinative, since the tracing service also listed the consumer as residing at a different address at the same point in time. Go figure. There's one there. That, again, is a case for that we've had, First Select Company versus Master Matty. Boy, that must have been a real interesting case, because that has covered all sorts of things here. That must have been a real mess when you have a case citation that's used for as many things as this one is. Additional errors as to mailing address can occur where the customer the consumer is married. In one case, service to the consumer's ex-husband's address was improper because the consumer never resided at that address. Well, geez, that happens. People get divorced. How about Palisades Collection LLC versus Lieber, spelled L-I-E-B-E-R. It's New Jersey Superior Court, Appeals Division, August of 07. Other times, husband and wife will both be sued, but service will be received by only one spouse. For example, consider where husband and wife lived at the same address. The husband opened the mail service, but never informed the wife about the service. A hearing should be held on whether service on the wife was proper, where both husband and wife submit affidavits that the wife never saw or knew about the summons. Well, you know, depending on how well people are getting together, that can happen. There is a case citation real quick here that you've already got. TCC Management versus CLAP. That's Ohio Court of Appeals, August of 05. proper notice of the default hearing, and this is something, there's a lot of people that have gotten default judgments against them that need to be able to do something about it. And that's one of the reasons why I'm taking as much time as I am on this stuff, because getting rid of default judgments is something that everybody needs to do if you've got the opportunity. Obtaining a default judgment is a two-step process in many states. The consumer is summoned with a complaint, and failure to respond within a specified time period leads to a default. The collector then files a motion to turn that default into a judgment. State rules patterned after Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 55B2 require that the collector serve the consumer with written notice of its application for a default judgment if the consumer has filed an appearance in the case. Okay? If you filed an appearance into the case, and filing an appearance into the case, in case you don't know it, doesn't necessarily mean that you filed an answer. You could have filed a motion to dismiss. That is also an appearance. Okay, 108 is the footnote. The federal rule specifies 3 days notice, but state rules may require more time. There's a very, let's see, McKinney, 5 days, Louisiana, 7 days, Massachusetts, 7 days, Ohio, 7 days. They were giving some examples here. When the consumer is not sent the second notice, the resulting default judgment can later be set aside. Okay, case citation on that is National City Bank of Michigan / Illinois versus Hayden, H-A-Y-D-E-N. That is a Michigan Court of Appeals case from January of 2003. Another one is Lindblom, spelled L-I-N-D-B-L-O-M, v. Prime Hospitality Corporation. And that is a Nevada 2004 case. And one more, Meglan, M-E-G-L-A-N, Meglan again, and Company. So it's Meglan, Meglan, and Company versus Bostic, B-O-S-T-I-C. It's Ohio Court of Appeals. May 9th of 2006. One more is Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Springer. That is an Ohio Court of Appeals from November of 2004. Right. Just as a consumer must be properly served the lawsuit itself, the consumer must be properly served the motion for a default judgment. That makes sense. The federal rule and many state rules limit the right to this additional notice to situations in which the consumer has filed an appearance. In a surprising number of default judgments, the consumer has in fact filed an appearance, even though the consumer has defaulted. For example, where states require the consumer to file both an appearance and an answer, unrepresented consumers may mistakenly believe that filing an appearance is enough. Merely filing the appearance may not stop a default, but it entitles the consumer to the second notice. Oh, that's important. Merely filing the appearance may not stop a default, but it entitles the consumer to the second notice. And if they don't send you the second notice, you don't have due process, you can get it voided. Moreover, some courts have construed appearance broadly to include conduct and communications prior to the filing of an action, even when a defendant does not make an appearance after the case is commenced. All right, a couple case citations on that. Lindblom, Lindblom, versus Prime Hospitality Corporation. This is a familiar one. And it is Nevada 2004. And there's a comment here. Pre-suit interactions evinced a clear intent to appear and defend. Okay. In Texas, notice of the motion for a default judgment must be sent if the consumer answers, and a verified letter from the consumer was found to be such an answer, even though not in proper form as an answer. Okay. Case citation on that. Reed, R-E-I-D, versus Asset Acceptance, LLC. And that is Texas Appeals from October of 2006. Some states require that the collector serve notice of the hearing on the default judgment on the consumer, even when the consumer does not file an appearance. Okay. Now, right here, I want to stop. This is why you have to read the local rules of the court that you are in, or if you're being sued in a court. If you're suing somebody in federal court or state court, you need to know what the local rules are. Here again, some states require that the collector serve notice of the hearing on the default judgment on the consumer, even when the consumer does not file an appearance. In New York, if more than 1 year has elapsed since the entry of default, a defendant, even one who has not filed an appearance, must still be given notice of the hearing for a default judgment. Even if 1 year has not elapsed, notice must be sent if the action is based upon the non-payment of a contractual obligation and is not filed in small claims court. If the notice is returned as undeliverable, or if the residence is unknown, then it must be mailed to the party's place of employment if known. In other words, they really got to make an effort to let you know before they can just whack you. But how many times do they not do that? And we, the uninformed public, before we got involved in this, didn't know that we can do something about it. If that is unknown, it must be mailed on the last known address, or to the last known address. All right. Notice of the motion for a default judgment is just as important where the parties stipulate to a default judgment if the consumer does not make promised payments. And a stipulated judgment, for those of you that are not familiar with that, that's one where you both agree on something. A stipulated judgment would be a judgment that you agree with them on. And quite frankly, I would never agree with anybody on a judgment. If you're going to try and get a judgment against me, have at it, but I'm not going to stipulate to it unless it's really, 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 really in my favor. And with these people, it's not going to be. For example, in one case, the stipulation provided that a default judgment would be entered if the consumer did not make specified payments, but that the consumer would receive 10 days' notice before judgment would be entered. The judgment could be vacated because the 10-day notice was not provided. Okay, I'm going to give you a case citation on that one. Capital One Bank versus Hembrick, H-E-M-B-R-I-C-K. That is a New York civil court from 2007. All right. And I am going to call it right there because we've run a bit over here. I'm going to touch one more thing next week. In fact, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go over one more thing here. I'm going to skip one thing. Let's do this real quick. Any other reason that justifies relief? Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B6 provides that a default judgment can be reopened for any other reason that justifies relief, quotes unquote, on any other reason that justifies relief. There is no one-year limit on the consumer's ability to raise this reason as ground for relief as long as the motion is brought within a reasonable time. Okay, and then I'm sure we're going to get into what's reasonable. Case citation here is First Resolution Investment Corporation. That's First Resolution Investment Corp. versus Coffey, COFFEY. Ohio Court of Appeals, December of 2007. This approach is an attractive alternative for a consumer when more than a year has elapsed and when it is thus no longer possible to set aside the judgment for excusable neglect. And we talked about excusable neglect. The United States Supreme Court, in interpreting the federal rule, finds that, quote, any other reason that justifies relief, unquote, is limited to, quote, extraordinary circumstances, unquote, beyond the movement's control, and not just to excusable neglect. Okay. Pioneer Investment Services Company versus Brunswick, Brunswick Associates. And that is a United States Supreme Court case, I believe. You can look that one up. There's a real long citation. It's from 1993. Okay, the circumstances must suggest that the party is faultless in the delay. In other words, it's not my fault. It's not my fault that it took me until now to do this. All right, state courts and state rules may also limit this basis for relief to extraordinary circumstances. Okay, you got a case citation there again, Pioneer Services versus Brunswick, the one we just had. And then I'm going to give you another one, Webb, versus Erickson, Erickson. Arizona case from 1982. It should not be used to undermine the time constraints applicable to Rule 60B's other subsections. Okay. Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Moberly, M-O-B-E-R-L-Y. And that is a 2007 case from Kentucky. As the rule states any other reason, this section does not include grounds mentioned in the prior sections. Okay. Webb versus Erickson is another the case there. We've already done that one. That is Arizona from 1982. Yeah, I'm going to read this last sentence. As the rule states any other reason, this section does not include grounds mentioned in the prior sections, such as excusable neglect. The standard is not an impossible one to meet. The Arizona Supreme Court has quoted the United States Supreme Court approvingly regarding this ground to set aside a judgment. It, quote, vests power in courts adequate to enable them to vacate judgments whenever such action is appropriate to accomplish justice. I'm going to read that again because that quotation vests power in courts adequate to enable them to vacate judgments whenever such action is appropriate to accomplish justice. And that is a very powerful statement. When you use those kind of words, you know, you're always interested in reminding the court that you're just looking for justice. Justice should not be denied. And again, case citation there is Webb versus Erickson. Same one we've mentioned, Arizona, 1982. The United States Supreme Court found, quote, any other reason that justifies relief, unquote, present when an individual's incarceration, ill health, and other factors beyond his reasonable control prevented him from seeking to reopen a default judgment for 4 years. Okay, there's a case citation on this. Claprot, spelled Claprott, versus United States. And that's going to be a Supreme Court case from 1949. The Arizona Supreme Court has found exceptional circumstances to set aside a default judgment after 4.5 years when the individual had no reason to believe the action was related to that individual, the summons and writ were confusing, and the individual's mental and physical condition was impaired at the time. All right, that's Webb versus Erickson, again, from 1982. Another factor was the lack of notice of the default judgment. Okay, they got to give you notice. In another case, a default judgment was reopened for exceptional circumstances after 9 years had passed. Now, that's pretty good. That's case citation is New York Hospital versus Robinson. That's R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N. And that is a New Jersey Superior Court appeals from May of 99. 9 years. The consumer contacted Medicaid about a hospital bill. Hospitals may not sue Medicaid recipients, and was told it would be taken care of. Then, on receipt of the default judgment, the consumer contacted the collector's law firm to explain that Medicaid said it would take care of the matter. 9 years later, immediately after the first garnishment of the consumer's wages, the consumer sought to reopen the default. Upon denial, she sought legal assistance. The court in these circumstances found the failure to respond to the complaint to be justified and allowed the default judgment to be set aside. Reopening a judgment was also proper when the consumer's representative had deceived the consumer into believing the representative was a licensed attorney. And oh boy, do we ever have any problems with that out there? How about MBNA America Bank versus Garcia? And that is an Oregon Court of Appeals from 2009. An Ohio appellate court has even approved reopening a default for exceptional circumstances primarily because the consumer's complaint was defective and the consumer denied owing the debt. And that is Mercy Franciscan Hospital versus Willis, W-I-L-L-I-S, Ohio Court of Appeals, September of 2004. Similarly, a trial court found exceptional circumstances to reopen a default judgment after 2 years where the consumer's alcoholism made her incapable of managing her affairs. Now, boy, that's a good one, isn't it? A drunk couldn't handle her affairs, and they let it reopen. Okay, 143 is a footnote. Asset Acceptance, LLC, versus Moberly, M-O-B-E-R-L-Y. And that's a Kentucky 2007 case. After various appellate decisions, the trial court was eventually overruled because the consumer had failed to present medical evidence of the consumer's incapacity or to show that the consumer was incapacitated over much of the intervening period. And again, that's Asset Acceptance versus Moberly. Another court refused to reopen a default judgment for exceptional circumstances when the consumer was incapacitated for 18 months, but waited over 3 years to move to reopen the default. See, if you've got something like this, you've got to deal with it. There is a case citation there, and then we're done here. Great Seneca Finance Corporation versus Dweck, spelled D-W-E-K, is in New Jersey Superior Court Appeals, April of 2008. You know, I could go on with stuff for hours. I know there was a lot of detail in here, but there's a lot of different scenarios where people can have default judgments, and that's why I've spent as much time on this, so that it covers things and hopefully covers a situation that some of you may have out there where you've had a default judgment, because there's many people that have gotten them simply because of their lack of knowledge on how to deal with this stuff. So it's very important to learn these things and get this information out so people can utilize it to their benefit. All right, now what I'm going to do, as per usual, I'm going to unmute everybody, and I'm going to ask everybody to have your fingers ready to hit star 6, because I can't selectively unmute people. I'm going to unmute everyone, and then please hit star 6 and mute yourself out. And if you have a comment or a question, press star 8 to put yourself in the queue